Okay, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the second lecture on principles of banking. Do you have any questions regarding yesterday's presentation or yesterday's lectures in mind? Okay, no questions there. So I now inserted the link to the Moniviestin recordings of the Zoom lectures, and you should be using the same link. And there's always this path key that you have to use to be able to connect to the recordings of the lectures. You can take a look at those afterwards also. But let's continue now from these things here. Okay, so we are now, we ended our lecture yesterday to the discussion of these data series for the deficit or the surplus of the Federal Reserve. And as you observe from the time series, we have had these unexceptional periods also regarding the development, these things. And this has been enabled by the actions that the Federal Reserve has been doing in the financial market. So they have been buying the debt securities of the federal government. And the ECB has been doing the same thing here in the European markets through the individual member banks of the ECB system. So, for example, the Finnish Bank of Finland is buying the Finnish government bonds under the instructions of the ECB, how much to buy those. So that is the main thing for you to understand in terms of this. And this is actually in terms of equations that us, the economists, are very much in love with. You can analyze these things based on the simple dynamic budget condition for the general public or the government sector. But there are also other markets that are really relevant for you as a future prominent bankers or participants in financial markets. And the one is foreign exchange market. And also I would like to highlight here that for the foreign exchange markets regarding the exchange rates, you can actually calculate the rates of return for each and every currency. And in the course of international finance, we will be dealing a lot more with these things. Kari Heimonen will be teaching the economics of exchange rates there. And then Vanja Piljak and Heikki Lehkonen will be dealing the stock market segment of international financial markets. So we are talking about very much about arbitrage possibilities in the stock markets and interest yielding asset markets. But in that case, you are extending the portfolio possibilities towards international possibilities too. So you are not only buying domestic firms or domestic stocks or domestic interest yielding assets, you are buying also foreign. And obviously, during your period or the holding period of your assets, the relevant thing that has an effect on your value, on the value of your portfolio, is the change in the exchange rate, either the nominal change or the real change. In the case of real change, you take into account also the inflation differences between your home country and the country that you are investing in. And that should be the main relevant thing as a very sophisticated economist or financial market participant for you to look into, because that is the only thing, the real interest rate or real rate of return from investing also abroad, that gives you possibilities to increase your future consumption possibilities. Okay, so the foreign exchange rate market is the one that we are not dealing too much here because we are more interested about banking sector, but it's obviously very important for you to understand also the main ideas in the international finance literature or international finance financial systems. So, for example, how does the country's choice of exchange rate policy affect its monetary policy? And how do the capital controls impact domestic financial systems and therefore the performance of the economy? Nowadays, a relevant thing that is being introduced to these discussions is the role of cryptocurrencies, for example. There are now at least one country that has adopted actually the Bitcoin as one of the possible mediums of exchange. So that is a bit questionable thing because it's a highly speculative thing. We don't actually know who are the participants in the markets for the Bitcoin. So that is the reason why San Salvador that introduced the Bitcoin possibility is also using US dollar as one of the as the main currency in the in their actions, financial and every other actions. But it's an interesting thing that one sovereign entity, one country has now introduced actually Bitcoin as an official medium of exchange. It's a questionable thing. And I'm pretty sure that Dennis will be also discussing about this possibility and also perhaps Oliver Karuskan. But nevertheless, the exchange rate is the price of the currency. And in many cases, we measure the own country's value of currency with respect to some global currencies like the US dollars and euro or Japanese yen. And in international funds markets and international currency markets, there should be kind of a parity relationships between these exchange rates that are determined by the country-specific factors that has an effect on the valuation of that currency in question. Karin will be discussing a lot more about these things in the international finance course and Heikki also, so we are not paying too much attention to that. But nevertheless, pay always attention on the basics or the basis of calculation. How do you calculate that, for example, dollar value in this case? Here we are using the trade-weighted US dollar, which means that all the main trading partners in international trade are being taken into account when you value the US dollar here. This is the usual way to measure the things. And when the price of the US dollar goes up, it's appreciating. And when it comes down, it's depreciating. So in terms of the valuation of the currency for the domestic firms, it would be beneficial if the value is the lowest possible. But at the other side of the coin, there is the question about the reliability or the performance of the real economy. Is it doing well if the value is very low? For example, for the Latin American countries, their currency values are really very low, and they are also very volatile, and their economies are not doing very well. So the valuation of currency is obviously also in connection to real economic activity. And it's also very much in connection to the inflation rate. The more there's volatility and the lower is the value of the currency, probably the more there is inflation in that economy. And we will be discussing about these real economic relationships in more detail in the second part of the lectures. You get, should get an idea about the connections between the country-level inflation rates to the valuation of their interest-yielding asset markets and also to their currency, because it is, it's a relevant thing there. So basically, one of the explanations why the US economy has been doing quite well is, first of all, that its currency value is fairly, it's not volatile, it's not too volatile, and it has actually, right from the survival, start of the survival period from the COVID-19 crisis after spring 2020, it has been actually depreciating. So the domestic US firms have been doing quite well in international trade. And that is actually one of the reasons why the US economy is being seen quite strong at the moment. The growth rate of the real economy there is quite strong. It's stronger than in the euro area. One of the many reasons, in addition to these unconventional monetary policy actions and very low interest rates there, is the valuation of the US dollar against its main trading partners. This is in simple, very short description of the main ideas in this international trade flows that you will be discussing quite a lot in the international finance course. So obviously, you have to recognize that everything nowadays is international. For example, the cryptocurrency markets are very international. Now that San Salvador had introduced Bitcoin to their as one of the of more or less official mediums of exchange, they have introduced a huge risk factor to their economy because the valuation of Bitcoin is completely based on other things than the San Salvador economy. So that is really very risky thing that they are doing there at the moment. But nevertheless, it's very important for you to understand nowadays that each and every segment of the financial market sector is very international at the moment. So for example, the Finnish government bonds are being actively traded in international financial markets. One participant there is the ECB through the Bank of Finland actions. So they are buying and they are selling. And nowadays they are more buying than they are selling. So they have an effect as a big market participant. They have an effect on the valuation of the Finnish government bonds. Their demand keeps that at an adequate level, so the interest rate stays low. And it's there on the negative side still at the moment. I should mention that in let's say 10 years ago, in standard economics books, textbooks, and financial economics textbooks, we didn't even realize the possibility for negative interest rates. And it was a bit sort of a strange thing to be thought afterwards, because it's only natural if the quotation of the interest rates are based on the quotation of the prices of the assets. They can go below zero. It's possible. The prices are never basically not in any markets. The prices are never negative, but the interest rates can be negative. It's completely based on the holding period of the asset and how do the prices evolve during the holding period. Okay, so it's possible. And nowadays, the textbooks are also introducing this possibility, even though it's a strange thing in terms of the standard discounting ideas, but they are now introducing this possibility also. So obviously, this is a slide that it's actually unnecessary for you because you are interested about these things. And if you understand these well, these simple things, starting from the pricing of the assets, what are the main fundamental things that have an effect on the prices? And after that, you are able to calculate the returns. You should be able to understand those. Because usually, for example, in the if you follow the financial media, everyday financial media, you don't get the stock returns there. You get the index development. You get the prices of the individual stocks and the general index. You yourself have to calculate the relevant rate of return that is based on your holding period idea. How long are you willing to hold the asset in your portfolio? Okay, so one of the main important things in this course is to be present you the main ideas about the role of financial sector in general and especially the banking sector in channeling the monetary policy actions that the central banks do, because it seems to be actually the biggest factor in pricing of almost every asset nowadays. It's even, we have realized now that after the global financial crisis, it's the most relevant thing that has an effect on everything. It has an effect on stock markets. It has an effect on exchange rates. We have noticed this exchange rate effect and interest rate effects already before, but now we have noticed that it really has a strong effect also on the stock markets. Okay, so monetary policy is really, really important to understand. And the main idea in this course is to analyze everything based on the idea of equilibrium. And we present this equilibrium in the standard economics literature way. So we analyze the intersection of demands and supply curves. all the time. And we define that in terms of the quantities, the x-axis, and prices in the y-axis. And we just have to realize now that we are mainly discussing about the interest yielding assets, and based on the simple idea of discounting, if the price goes up, the return comes down. That is the thing that you have to understand here, right from the beginning. So it's a basic supply and demand analysis to behavior, to explain the behavior in financial markets in general terms. Each and every sector in the economy is assumed to be searching for profits, not just the banking sector, but the investors in general, the firm sector that requires funding for their real investment needs for building factories and so on. They want to have profits also. Basically, also the household sector wants to have kind of a profits because they want to maximize their utility in terms of their consumption. So basically, the profit-like variable in the household sector is the utility. Marginal utility is the thing that you try to maximize when you optimize your behavior as a consumer. So we have an approach to financial structure that is based on transaction costs and asymmetric information. So the role of the banking sector comes here. The original idea has been that it is designed to reduce the transaction costs. So we don't need this kind of a dual need for meeting all the participants in the markets. We have these banking sector or the banks that are able to collect large sums of excess funding to be supplied, make those funds a bundle of supplied funding to those in need for funding. And that's the general, very simple idea of the banking sector. And it's also designed to reduce the adverse effects of asymmetric information. And those are the main things or the main reasons for the existence of the banking sector. And everything this is related to the role of the banking sector in the aggregate real economic development. What is the role of banking sector in enhancing real economic growth? So it's about supply and demand of production at the end of the day. That is the thing that we are interested about. So you have to understand some definitions. For some of you, this might be because we have these BIF students here that come from various backgrounds. Some of you might have not heard about these economics terms because some of you come from the engineering background, actually. So it's very relevant for you to sort of get the knowledge about these standard definitions. They're really simple and they are really important here. The most commonly reported measure of aggregate output referring to the real economic activity is the gross value, gross domestic product. It's by definition, it's a definition defined as the market value of all final goods and services produced in a country during the course of a year. So it's a flow variable. Not the stock variable, it's a flow variable. You measure something during the year. You have to make a clear difference. Also, the economic students majoring in economics get sometimes confused with these things. Make a clear difference between the flow values that are measured during the year or during the holding period and the stock variables that are measured at certain point of time. Like for the balance sheets and financial reports of the banks, they are usually measured at certain points of time. At the end of financial year, for example, or at the end of quarter. So they are stock values. So they are not flow values. You can measure the amount of assets at certain point of time. And between the quarters or between the years, if you measure the change in those stock values, then you are talking about flow. How much does it change during the holding period or measurement period? Okay, so aggregate income, total income and factors, production. And the main factors of production are assumed to be land, labor, and capital from producing the goods and services in the economy during the course of the year. that's equal to the aggregate output. This is the thing, or this is the animal that basically all the central banks are focusing quite a lot. They want to always sort of maximize the actual production. They want to maximize the use of potential of the uses of these factors of production each and every year. Be very careful with the definitions right from the beginning. When you are measuring things at the current prices, you're talking about nominal things. So you have nominal rates of return, nominal interests, nominal GDP, nominal income, nominal values of houses, and so on. But immediately when you take into account the role of general inflation that is related to the consumer prices, then you are deflating the nominal values. That's another concept that you have to understand, how to deflate things to real values. Because the real values are the things that we are mostly interested in, the economic models. And that comes to the from the basic assumption of the role of real consumption. Consuming the real things, like here, this is a real thing that I'm doing here. I'm teaching you a course. This is a real thing. And you are consuming food, you are consuming housing, you are consuming cars and so on. You can have a nominal value for those from the markets, but if you want to sort of have the real fundamental value for you, you should be taking into account all the roles, also the role of changes in prices. During your holding period, I want to emphasize always in this course the idea of holding period, because that is the most relevant thing in all investment behavior or all behavior in your everyday life. So a more reliable, literature says that it's a more reliable measure, but it's the more fundamental measure based on the models, is the real GDP. They are values that are calculated in constant values. So for example, you have to just choose the reference year from your data against which you want to measure all the other observations. Nowadays, in the calculation of CPI index, for example, we have the base year in Finland, it's 2020. So everything in real terms is measured to the prices of the same things in 2020. And that gives you an idea about the valuation of everything in terms of real values. Then one extremely important definition to be understood by you is this aggregate price level. There are various possibilities to measure the aggregate price level. So if you follow the financial media or any news, when they discuss about inflation, you should be, as an economist, as a sophisticated economist, you should be immediately worried about what kind of inflation, because there's various kinds of inflation in the economy. If you are talking about real economic, the aggregate values like consumption and production and investments, the guy that you should be using to measure the price development is the GDP deflator. That is the aggregate thing. So it's not based on just the prices of consumption goods. It's based on all the items in the measurement of GDP. So it increases also the price of public consumption, public expenditures, public investments, private investments, and also exports and imports in an open economy, not just the consumption sector. But usually we use the mostly used measure when we want to deflate the things in the financial markets or the returns in the financial markets. We have the nominal return or nominal prices, and we want to calculate the real values. We use the consumer price index. The main reason for that is that at the origins of the investment behavior are the consumers, basically. So you are interested about increasing your consumption possibilities as a consumer, not as a general welfare maximizer of the overall economy, not as a politician that attempts to maximize the overall wealth of the economy. So this is the one, the last item here is the one that we are using usually. PCE refers to the personal consumption expenditures. It's a bit different compared to the consumer price index. This is more, let's say, the coverage of the items is bigger in this one. And it is actually, you can measure that also in higher frequencies than the GDP deflator. In official statistics, GDP deflators are reported usually at the highest frequency. At the highest frequency for those is quarterly frequency. Another reason for using consumer price index in financial market analysis when you calculate real index or real values is that you can observe that at least at the monthly level. And monthly returns are in many cases the ones that you are also interested about. So there's a high frequency of available data for those. So here's perhaps the main important definitions for you to understand in terms of the role of funds and markets in general and the banking sector specifically. So in general terms, the funds and markets are designed to perform the essential function of channeling excess funds to those in need for funding for their real investment purposes or consumption purposes, to those that have a shortage of funds. And we can make a distinction between the direct finance. So borrowers borrow funds directly from lenders in funds and markets by selling them securities. And then the indirect finance. And in the indirect financing channel, we have the role of banking sector. So strong there. So in general terms, the financial markets are designed to promote economic efficiency by producing an efficient allocation of capital, which increases production. What does an efficiency mean here? What does an efficiency mean here? It refers to a situation where all the funds that the excess funding sector is willing to supply to those that are in need for those, it's being demanded. So there are no residual funds that are being left unused. So all the funding is in excess. It's in efficient use. There are no excess funds in any sector. This is a completely impossible situation. But the main thing for you to understand here is that for the purposes of meeting this efficiency requirement, the needs in terms of return requirement for those that are willing to supply the funding should meet the willingness to pay the cost for getting the funding by those that are in need for funding. So the pricing of, once again, the pricing of this funding is the relevant thing. So obviously the suppliers of funding would like to have the highest possible return. Let's not pay too much attention to the risk attitudes, but in general terms, you want to have the highest possible return. And those that are in need for getting funding would like to pay the lowest possible cost, the lowest possible interest rate. And actually, the banking firm is dealing here in this quite close margin nowadays when you have these very low interest rates. They try to make their profits from this difference, actually, to put it simply. The original idea of all this efficient allocation of resources or capital is to improve the well-being of consumers by allowing them to time their purchases better. So you can take a loan and pay that loan back in a couple of years of time to purchase a car, to purchase a house, purchase anything. So it helps in smoothing your consumption over time. That is the general idea. So this is a figure that you should understand completely when we discuss about the flow of funds through the financial system. So we have here these lenders and savers. So here we have these individual sectors in the definition of gross domestic product. So households do their consumption, business firms do their investments, governments do their expenses, make expenses and also tax the people and the general public, and foreigners also have a role. They demand your production and they are also willing to supply their production to you. So by definition, this is an open economy. This is based on the open economy definition for the GDP. But each and every one of these sectors can be an excess supplier of funding. They can have something that is being left out of their disposable income as savings, each and every sector. So if they engage into direct channel of funding those that are in need. So you have the same arguments or same items, same animals there in this blue box here. Business firms, they are the biggest demanders of funding. This is in the order of importance in both cases. So households are assumed to be biggest suppliers of funding, and business firms are the biggest in need for funding. And then the government is a big player. Nowadays, it's a huge player. It's even more important in terms of needing the funding than the firm sector in aggregate terms. And then the households and foreigners are there. So if you engage in dealing with stocks, for example, then you are participating to the direct channel of channeling funding to the other participants of the aggregate economy. But immediately when you go to a bank to take a loan or supply a deposit there, then you are involved with the role of bank sector in general. These financial intermediaries includes many other institutions than just simple banks. It includes insurance companies, hedge funds, and these kind of things. But the main idea there is that you are able to channel your funding through a financial intermediary that takes the role of gathering the relevant information regarding the customers that are in need for funding. If you go and engage to the, let's say that you want, if you really want to participate into the funding of business firms, you would engage into an initial public offering in the stock markets, not just to the secondary markets. Secondary markets are important in terms of having an effect on the liquidity of IPO markets, initial public offerings that are used for real investment purposes. Is there anyone here that has never heard about IPO? You have heard about those. So that's the primary market for funding. That's the thing that takes place here in the financial markets. You are in charge as an investor yourself to get the relevant information, whether it is profitable for you to invest into that firm. But if you make a claim for share through, for example, hedge fund, then the guys in the hedge fund take the charge of getting the relevant information, and they buy your share of their fund at a certain price. But after that, the fund managers start to do the things with your funds, and they might keep you informed about the development of your share value and so on. But if you engage indirectly to the financial market, so you, for example, buy a government bond, you don't need the bank necessary. You just have to have kind of a transaction account in a bank to buy government bonds. Nowadays, you can even buy sophisticated commodity market products like ETFs through your bank account, basically. But you are completely in charge yourself about the relevant information about the acquirement, what are you buying at in terms of the asset. So this is still a valid thing in terms of the general ideas about the functioning of financial markets, even though we have now seeing the introduction of various possibilities for example, investments in cryptocurrencies. Cryptocurrencies are not being traded in these official financial intermediation firms. They are not being regulated so efficiently, so they involve much more risk. You can go to the platforms, Coinbase and these things, and you can buy cryptocurrencies. But I should warn you, if you are not fully aware of the things that are taking place behind that, don't go there. At least wait for a couple of years when the central banks have introduced these digital currencies and so on. The trading with those will start. And they are using the stable coins as the basis for those valuations, then you should, in general terms, perhaps get involved with those. There might be some of you that have already been involved with all dealing with these cryptocurrencies, but there are losers and there are winners. And in both cases, there are big chances to lose a big amount of money or win a big amount of money. So the risk is huge. They are completely outside of this figure. They are not official things in terms of channeling the funds for the needs of the real economic sectors. Okay, so another definition or distinction between the market segments is that you have to make a clear distinction between the debt markets and equity markets. Equity markets are referring to the using of stocks. So you, as an owner of a firm, you are entitled to the residual income after everyone else, like the claimants or the banks regarding the debts or the loans of the firms, they get their share first from the profits. When you go to the equity markets and buy shares, you get your dividend yield or dividend return only after everyone else has got their share. So that's obviously a risk also for you. So there's a, this is one of the clear big distinctions between these markets. Another thing that is very important for you to understand is to make a distinction between primary and secondary markets. Investment banks underwrite securities in primary markets. So for example, IPOs take place, or investment banks are the ones that sort of do the IPOs for the firms. The firms in need for funding for their, they want to build up a factory, they want to have a funding there, they are not willing to go to a bank, they think that they could organize based on their current financial situation and future prospects, they can organize a fairly low cost initial public offering for their investment. So they go to an investment bank and it designs the whole thing for them and they just get the funding. But when we are talking about the valuation of those assets after the initial public offering, when the trading with those assets starts actually in the markets, we are then talking about secondary markets. Secondary markets have a big role in terms of affecting the liquidity in the financial markets in general. The higher is the liquidity in the financial markets in general, the easier it's also for the firms to, for example, organize an IPO. The lower is the liquidity, the lesser are their chances for the firms to get the funding for the IPOs. Because in general terms, there's lots more activity into markets, so your firm level IPOs might be also interesting to the investors there when there's lots of things going on. Activity is strong. So brokers and dealers that are actually big players in these investment banks, their activities involve actions in primary markets and secondary markets. They are the ones that have the biggest role in defining the prices of the assets in the markets. And there are some official places for exchanges. You obviously know that there are lots of stock exchanges, for example, in the world. And these are perhaps the primary exchanges that have a physical location. That's the main definition for the stock exchanges. They have a physical location. They have walls. We have now seen during the COVID time that it's not absolutely necessary to have walls for anything. So it might be the case that even the stock exchanges do not need walls in the future anymore. So they will be going towards more like these over-the-counter markets that do not have a physical location at all, basically. Everything takes place in the internet. Basically, also about stock exchanges, main part of the buying and selling activities usually takes place in the internet, but they still have the walls. So a standard or the old traditional way to define an exchange is that it has basically a physical location. And then another thing that now also you should bear in mind all the time is that when we are talking about money markets compared to capital markets, there's a big difference in terms of the holding period and maturity of the assets. So when we are talking about money markets, we are always talking about short-term debt instruments. And the main distincting or the threshold in terms of the maturity is 1 year maturity. Everything that has a maturity below 1 year, 1 year or below that, is termed as money market instrument, regardless of its nature, whether it's an interest-yielding asset or whether it's a derivative. If its maturity is lower, equal or lower than 1 year, then it's referring to the money market instruments. Capital markets are the definition for the longer term assets in every respect. So everything that is being traded at the longer than 1 year maturity is referred to a capital market item. So there are lots of debt instruments that are quoted in both these markets. And previously, when we talked about monetary policy before the global financial crisis, we were usually talking about the central bank involvement to the money market below 1 year maturity. But nowadays, it's a disaster. They are very much involved in all the possible maturities, also for the 30-year long-term government bonds. They have lots of those in their balance sheets at the moment. And this is something that clearly disturbs the main idea about the distinction between monetary policy actions and fiscal policy actions, because fiscal policy is about the modification, it's about the modification of the budget needs in the general government sector. So it's really annoying thing for a plain economist like I am, because you have to discuss about these things in the same basket or in the same model, basically. You cannot make a distinction between monetary policy and fiscal policies anymore. So they are very much involved. Here are some volumes about the money market instruments. So when we are talking about the maturities below 1 year, in the US market, for example, a long-term development shows here that they have been increasing quite a lot, except for the commercial papers. In most recent years, the role of commercial papers actually has increased also quite a lot. So this is the, let's say, more historical development of these. But there are lots of assets that have been traded in the money market sector. And in the longer term or in the longer maturities, one of the things that you have to notify here is that the capital market instruments includes the corporate stocks, because the stock market is defined to be a long-term investment market. Originally, firms require funding from the primary markets for their long-term investment purposes. They want to build up a factory that is supposed to last there for 30 years or something like that. And in terms of that need, we define the stock market to be a long-term capital market also from the point of view of the investor. Obviously, the definition for you as an individual investor in stock markets depends on your holding period once again. Even though you are dealing with the, based on the definition of a long-term instrument for with the stocks, you might be dealing only for a very short period of time with those. But the original needs for the funding come from the long-term needs of the firms. Mortgages are, housing loans are obviously long-term investments. Corporate bonds are, with the maturity over 1 year, they are long-term investments. US government securities with varying maturities, they are also long-term investments, and government agency securities, state and local government bonds, and bank commercial loans and consumer loans with varying maturities. You can have obviously consumer loans, for example, also, and bank commercial loans at the lower than 1 year maturities also, but they are included now. Parts of them are also included to the definition of the longer term investment. You just have to remember that the main thing, the main distinction between these is the maturity. What is the maturity of the asset? Is it below 1 year or is it over 1 year? So for example, corporate bonds and corporate stocks, you can have indefinitely in your portfolio. You can buy Nokia, you could have been buying Nokia shares like 30 years ago, and you could still have those. Their value would be huge at the moment. So it's a very, there's a possibility to hold that also for a very long term. Then foreign bonds are obviously an interesting possibility in your portfolio. Euro bonds are bonds that are denominated in a currency other than that of the country in which it is sold. Euro currencies are foreign currencies deposited in banks outside the home country. And euro dollars are specifically a definition for the US dollars that are deposited in foreign banks outside the US or in foreign banks of US banks. So we have clear definitions for all these forms of assets in international markets. And Kari Heinonen will probably, or at least Vanja Piljak will be discussing about the pricing ideas of these assets in much more details. We don't pay too much attention to those. But they are nowadays very relevant things in international finance markets in terms of trading activities. So the idea in the indirect financing channel is to lower transaction costs. That's the primary idea. You are given a chance to save money and time in carrying out financial transactions. So you don't have to have this double coincidence of needs because someone is taking care of all of you that are willing to supply funding to those that are in need for funding. And the bank sector is willing to do the information gathering process regarding both these participants in the markets. So basically the information is the sort of a thing that the banks are dealing with, information about the customers at both sides of their balance sheet. And the balance sheet is actually the profit-making machine of a banking firm. We will be going through that in very, very much details quite soon. So it enables to have more economies of scale, and the banking sector is very important in providing these liquidity services for the firms and households. And nowadays, these electronic forms of payments and electronic forms of liquidity supply are really important in the banking sector. Another thing that is important is that it's designed to reduce the exposure of investors to risk. And this is related to that role of information gathering by the banking sector. So it's doing the risk sharing task. So it's doing asset transformation. It's transforming various assets to liabilities with various characteristics. So we will be discussing about this. And by definition, also it enables, based on this, it enables the possibility to do some diversification, portfolio optimization by the banking sector. So it's about playing, selling assets for long and buying liabilities for short. That's the main thing, actually, that the banks are doing in terms of this asset transformation and liability management in their activities. We will go these through very carefully when we start to discuss about the functioning of banking firm. So they deal with, their main idea is to deal with asymmetric information problems. So before the transaction, you might have a possibility for this so-called adverse selection. So when the banks are designed to reduce the effect of this, they are designed to help in avoiding risky borrowers to get funding by gathering information about them before the transaction takes place. The second one is the moral hazard case, and that is related to the situation after the transaction. So it might be the case that borrowers might engage into activities that they have originally not informed the other participants to be taken. So the banks are designed to prohibit this kind of behavior. So they are monitoring their customers afterwards when they have given the loan to the customers. Are they able to pay their monthly payments? Are they able to pay the interest costs on the banks and so on? So this is to reduce the moral hazard. So these are economics definitions of these two main forms of asymmetric information, adverse selection and moral hazard. These are really simple things, but actually if you want to design an optimal amount of effort to be given to these functions, it's not an easy task because you have various kinds of projects to be financed, various kinds of customers to be monitored. So you have to be able to somehow to detect the risk structure of all the customers. And it's basically not possible. You have to have some kind of statistical distribution to give you an idea about the average risk profile of the customer. So the banks are using sophisticated statistical methods to calculate so-called value at risk values, for example, for their loan portfolios and so on. And it's dependent on the default possibilities of the customers, for example. So this seems to be a very simple thing, obvious thing for the banks to do, but the tools that are being used here are really very sophisticated, and they are mainly based on statistical theories and statistical ideas about the distribution of the returns from their portfolios, for example, loan portfolios. Okay. So funds and intermediaries allow small savers and borrowers to benefit from the existence of funds markets. This is the plain simple idea for the role of banking sector in general. And here's the list of possible forms of banks. The main idea here is for you to understand that in each and every case, the liabilities are mainly consisting of deposits. There are other liabilities also. If the bank takes a loan from another bank, it's a liability for that bank, and it's an asset for the other bank. But the main part should, in the profit-making machine, that is the balance sheet of each and every bank, should be consisting of deposits with varying maturities. And then the primary assets, there are lots of classifications for the primary assets, various forms of loans, housing loans, consumer loans, and other things. And also they can invest to other banks, the government, securities. Mortgages are the most important for savings and loan associations and for mutual saving banks. Mortgages are the most important here. We have listed the primary assets or the most important categories of these assets. But nevertheless, this is a thing that should be giving a bank a return. And these are the items that are imposing a cost to the bank. In normal times, once again, I have to emphasize here that during the period of negative interest rates, this is actually quite a perverse situation, because when you are paying a negative interest rate on a deposit, it's not anymore a cost item for the bank, but it's a cost item for the customer. The customer is willing to pay a certain small amount of capital for the bank in terms of, in the form of negative interest rate for her deposits, just for the sake of having those assets, customer assets, in a safe place. And that is actually one of the reasons why also government securities have been denoted to have negative interest rates for a long period of time already, many years, because governments have been, at least in the European context, they have been denoted to be the most default-free agents of all the economies. They will never collapse. We have individual cases about Latin American countries that are have been close to collapse, actually. But for example, at the European level, we don't have a big possibility for any of the current governments to collapse or go default. So this is a thing that it's still working, but the role of costs and returns has been reversed a bit, at least. I just finished the paper with one of my last year master's thesis students about the role of negative interest rates in having an effect on the main profit-making item of banking firms, that is the net interest margin, the difference between loans on average and deposits on average. And we saw that actually the net interest margins have not suffered in 154 European or euro area banks too much, because the banks have been able to use their interbank markets to get funding from other banks with a negative interest rate. So if you have to pay a lower amount of capital back to the other bank at the end of the maturity, then obviously it is an item that increases your net interest margin. And it's actually an interesting thing that the net interest margins have not suffered too much, but in overall terms, the other profitability measures like return on assets and return on equity and risk adjusted measures for these things, they have suffered a lot. So banks have not been, in general terms, too much able to shift their businesses towards other items, other profitable items from the standard loan giving process to the customers. So basically, they have not been able to fully utilize this benefit from negative interest rates based on the wholesale funding from the banking markets.
When I'm thinking about the especially local banks like Finland, that increasing regulation is something that they constantly mention, that it's forcing especially the small banks to make collaboration with the bigger banks.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the reasons.
Has there been research on that?
Well, the monitoring costs for the you refer to the banks in the savings banks group and OP banks, because they are really increasing tremendously amongst the smallest banks. And it is actually something that is forcing those to do more mergers and acquisitions. So basically, but there's no research, at least from what I know for the Finnish data, there's no research that what has been actually the effect of increasing pressure from the regulation, because the managing directors have to put a lot of effort nowadays to meet all the regulatory requirements, because each and every bank in Finland, regardless of its size, is being hit by the same amount of required information from the regulator. And it's really a huge burden for the managing directors They are not able to participate to the marketing operations and customer relationships so much than they were before this. So actually, it would be an interesting subject. I think that it would be possible to contact the OP group and get some kind of data about these effects. What is the effect on the probability of merger that comes from, I think that you had an idea, this idea that what would be the effect of increasing regulation pressure for the small banks in terms of the increasing the probability to have a merger with a bigger bank. That would be an interesting, it would require data from the whole overall OP group to do that, but I see no reason why you couldn't ask for the data from them. It should be interesting for them too, because it's obvious that it is one of the factors that has had an effect. But another thing is that actually these small banks have been quite profitable, especially when they have been sort of deficient in terms of the deposits, because they have been able to utilize the wholesale banking market in terms of the OP cooperative head of the OP cooperative, head office of the OP cooperative, because it has been able to gather funding with a negative interest rate from the European markets, and it has actually forwarded this benefit to the member banks. They have been able to gather the funding also with the negative interest rate from the central cooperative loans. So that has actually improved their net interest margin. I'm actually finishing a paper about this using the OP group data after I get enough time to focus on that once again. But I got these kind of results that actually the smaller banks have been also able to utilize this thing, this possibility that they have received. So for those banks that have been active in the wholesale markets, the increases in their interest rates might not be very good actually at the moment, because they lose that possibility to get profits more. So the net interest margins might suffer from that one. So then there are also these other things that we are not focusing too much. So we will be not discussing about the profit maximization ideas of life insurance companies and so on. We will be concentrating only on the banking sector, but these are also included to the forms of indirect financing sector. So there are these kind of intermediaries like savings institutions, life insurance companies, and these other insurance companies and pension funds and so on. But we are not focusing on those, on their behavior too much. And then we have these finance companies also. So we are now deviating from the standard idea of banking when we go towards these guys, because they are now, but they are included to the definition of the indirect financing channel. So they are not included to the direct channel, but they are components of the indirect financing channel. But we will not be talking about these too much, because we have other courses that will be concentrating on these things. Okay, but here's the development of the value of the assets of the primary financial intermediaries. And the main message from this is that simply that the banking sector is increasing all the time. It's not decreasing, it's strongly increasing over time, all the time. And also the life insurance companies have been increasing quite a lot. And so the general message is that this segment of indirect financing channel is increasing all the time, even though the direct channel, the stock markets and bond markets and so on, they are increasing all the time also. So the banking sector is also. Okay, so that's the main message. And you can take a more closer look at the most recent development from these Federal Flow of Funds accounts. And also through the ECB, you can find the figures for the development of the European or the Euro sector. Then a few slides about the meaning of these alternative finance channels. I was in an idea, I have been teaching about these or mentioning these things for 4 years already, and the development of these direct forms of channeling funding has been quite good until last year. Last year, we experienced a situation in China where the regulatory authorities imposed strong regulation to all forms of fintech firms in China. And actually, that market has more or less collapsed. Dennis will be giving you more details about that. And it's not so important anymore. So there is kind of a, you might say that there's COVID-19 effect in the development of these markets at the moment. But since the US economy, US markets are now developing more heavily, it might be the case that they will start again. So the volumes in these markets would start again. But for you as a student, it's only important for you to understand the role of these. If they start to become big players in the markets in the near future, then what is the main, what are the main forms of funds or channeling, fund channels that are available there? So there are two definitions. This presentation is based on the Cambridge University of Cambridge Judge School of Business annual report about these markets. They produce, this year they have produced the second global alternative finance report. And from there we see that because of the China situation, these markets more or less stagnated. So the development is nothing like that, that it was before that. But nevertheless, it's useful for you to understand something, some main ideas about this. So if we make a definition about alternative finance, then the point or the idea of definition depends on the viewer. If we are talking from the point of view of investment bankers, they treat those as non-traditional asset classes. They are alternative to the other forms of direct finance, stocks and bonds. And they are private placement of corporate debt funded by institutional investors instead of banks. And economists consider these alternative finance forms as sources of financing and payment channels that address the needs of individuals and businesses in economies lacking a functional banking system. So in those cases, for example, in the emerging African countries where the banking system have not been very good, the IT development and the internet development has resulted into a situation that these forms of funding have gained their importance there, for example, in some African countries. But the levels of funding that are being transferred to this system are still at only tens of millions of US dollars. So it's not a big thing still there. But it was a big thing in China. So here we have this Cambridge or Judge School of Finance business school definition, and Chicago is also using this. So they want to be treat those as instruments and channels of finance that originally emerge outside the regulated banking system. So the regulation is the main thing here. They are denoted to have been unregulated. Now that the China imposed regulation to these alternative finance platforms, the market more or less collapsed immediately. So the US financial market supervisors have to be very careful whether they want to enhance the development of this market or not. From the China experience, we have now evidence that if they want to regulate that market, they can pretty much destroy the whole market in one day, basically, if they impose strict regulation to the participants. So there's a distinction between the various types of alternative finance. Source of financing is one distinctive feature, and then use of proceeds provided by the financing and the instrument used to provide the financing. So here's the most recent definition. These definitions actually change because the markets have been developing quite a lot. So the definitions have been also changing. So this is not a very standard market yet, but completely dependent on the US authorities' attitude towards these markets, whether they consider them to be important or not for small and medium-term financing needs, for the startups and so on, that are willing to pay a high risk premium to the investors that are putting their funds in these markets. Whether the regulatory authorities in the US decide that it's not a good thing. We have this normal banking sector and we have this normal direct financing sectors that should be used. So they start to regulate these actions, then they might destroy the whole alternative finance market, actually more or less completely. But it's everything, the main feature here is that everything is digital. So the double needs of coincidence are met by digital forms of digital platforms. There's no walls anywhere. People sit in various places to do these activities and they don't have a common office at all. Everything takes place in digital form in the internet. Okay, so here are the lists of these models that are being used. So we have these debt models, first of all. So these are various forms of debt instruments. And here we don't have the distinction between the short term or the so-called money market instruments or longer term instruments. These are just debt instruments. So the maturity doesn't play a big role here, actually, because there's no active monetary policy player in these markets at all. There are no central bank that would be involved in these asset markets at all. So the definition regarding the maturity is not so important here. But the definition based on the debt markets and equity-based markets is the one that is relevant here. So we have these debt models and we have these equity-based models. But the main idea is that without a role of official stock exchange or anything kind of an exchange or a banking sector, you are able to meet the requirements of those in need for funding, and you are able to connect those that are willing to supply funding. So obviously the price of funding, the interest rates or the rates of return that are being required have to be higher here, because there's no collateral requirements. There's basically very limited screening of the customers here in the market. So the required rates of return have to be really, really something different compared to the other forms, normal forms of finance. There's a high risk premium in all these segments, actually. So if you are a risky investor, like a kind of an angel investor, for example, you would perhaps go to these markets and supply your funding to those in need for their real investment purposes. And you would get probably a quite high return, but with a high risk. You might risk losing everything in your investment. So this is a very risky segment of the finance market. So here is the idea about the role of China. So here you see from the last year, the first COVID-19 year, that immediately after, at the start of last year, the financial regulatory authorities imposed stricter regulations. So there was a huge number of bankruptcies in these fintech firms. The volumes, including China and excluding China, are pretty much the same. So China doesn't play basically any role anymore. This is a good example of the effects of regulation for an emerging financial market sector. China imposed a strong regulation there. So basically here are the examples of the volumes. So they are in terms of the absolute amounts of money that are being traded there. They are not so important anymore. So everything is dependent on the attitude of the US regulatory authorities, what kind of ideas do they have for the development of this sector in the future. So the next year, it might be the case that if the US regulatory authorities decide that they don't want to enhance the development of this market, I might not be lecturing this part of the lectures at all next year, because it doesn't play a big role. The volumes are here really small. For the whole US case, we have only $222 million. So it's not a big thing. It's really medium-sized bank in Europe, actually, $222 million. So it's not a big thing. Finally, I want to give you, if any one of you, I should warn you that this might be a dying industry. So perhaps you would not be interested in doing research, for example, in your master's thesis. But there are now some academic papers that are actually published in relevant journals that are focusing these things, and they are using mainly this data set that I presented to you that is available from the CHUTS Business School. And this is actually quite a nice paper. It's a very short paper. So for those of you that are interested about this, how do these alternative finance firms affect, for example, the requirement regarding the firm sector about their balance sheets information and financial statements information, disclosures, and so on. They do a very nice analysis on that. And they also give you a very nice overview of the most recent and early studies published in the academic research regarding this crowdfunding and alternative finance sources. So that is a good place to start the literature review, for example. But perhaps it is something that you should first discuss with me, whether it is relevant to take a look at these things and all, because everything is dependent on the US development now that China has more or less disappeared from these markets, actually. We had high hopes that the Chinese authorities, actually, Dennis is a fairly big fan of these things, actually. And we have been discussing with him about these things, but I actually mentioned him last year that if the Chinese authorities decide to do something in terms of regulation, then more than half of the markets would probably disappear. And it actually did happen. They decided to do this. And then the next step would be, what are the authorities doing in the US case? So it might be the case that I don't have to teach this next year anymore. And so this is a vanishing theme in banking courses. But we will see what happens. Okay. Few concepts. If we go back to the standard ideas in the standard banking research and standard banking models, to be able to get a good grip of the role of banks and financial intermediation in general, in terms of the real economic effects, you first have to understand the meaning of money. Money is not just coins and notes. Nowadays, you don't even have coins and notes in your wallets. You have various forms of electronic money. But nevertheless, money is the thing that keeps the economy rolling. It has just changed the form. So money supply is the thing in the economic models that is the most relevant thing in terms of when we are discussing about the effects of monetary policy actions. Central banks want to have an effect and want to have a control over the money supply. That is the main important thing. So anything that is accepted generally as a payment for goods or services or in the repayment of debts is defined to be money. So nowadays, San Salvador from today, they are considering also Bitcoin as a money. That was an error, because it's really highly speculative things, and we don't know the fundamental factors that have an effect for sure, San Salvador real economic factors don't play any role in the valuation of Bitcoin. So perhaps they made a huge error there. We will see that. So by definition, it's a very broad definition. And then you have to be able to, as an econometrician or economist, you have to be able to make a distinction between money, wealth, and income. They are completely different things. The general public usually mixes these or somehow gets confused with these definitions. They are very different things. Wealth is the total collection of all pieces of property that serve to store value. So you can have housing, you can have bonds, you can have bills, you can have stocks, you can have forests, you can have pretty much everything. But wealth is something that is measured as a stock measure. So at some certain point of time, you can measure wealth. How much money you have, how much assets you have, how much real investments you have, measure those at a certain point of time, like today. Not during a period, but at a certain point of time. Income is, by definition, a flow. It's a flow variable. It's a flow of earnings during a period of time. So like income on an annual basis. Income in monthly, your monthly salary is a flow variable, it's an income. So you have to make a distinction between these, because these, by definition, are different variables in economic models. You try to optimize your consumption, and the main thing that has a role to do there is, first of all, your income, your disposable income. And then the second item might be the wealth, if you are willing to sort of sacrifice part of your wealth for your consumption purposes. But that's a different thing compared to the income. For all this, you can use money to do the consumption in different forms of its existence at the moment. Okay, so be careful in this. We are mostly talking about the role of money in this course, not so much about the wealth components, and not so much about the income, but in general aggregate terms, we assume that all income comes from various forms of aggregate production. So the first function of money is to eliminate the double trouble of finding a double coincidence of needs. So that's the primary reason for having money in an economy. It promotes specialization. It must be easily standardized, widely accepted, divisible, easy to carry, not deteriorate quickly. What about Bitcoin? Does Bitcoin meet any of these requirements for standard medium of exchange, to your mind? Do you think it's widely accepted? Do you think it's easily standardized? Is it divisible? What's the value of one Bitcoin at the moment? Yeah, it depends completely on the sort of a measurement currency in terms of USD. It's 50, something like that. So is it divisible? Not very well, actually, because it's a huge amount. Is it easy to carry? Yeah, I think that it meets this one. Actually, it's fairly easy to carry. You can just connect to the platform and you can get the amount of Bitcoins in some other dollar or some other currency. But what about this? Not deteriorate quickly. This does not refer to the physical deterioration. It doesn't deteriorate in physical terms because it's an electronic form of currency, but in terms of value. Is there a possibility that it would deteriorate quickly? there is a strong possibility because it has been, its value has been changing quite a lot recently. So I should wonder the economists in San Salvador or the advisors of the government in San Salvador, what is the reason for taking Bitcoin as a medium of exchange in addition to the US dollar? So perhaps it's an attempt or it's a trial and error thing that they can withdraw within a fairly short period of time because they still have the US dollar also there. But it's an interesting thing that they did this actually. So it should be a reliable unit of account to enable the measurement of all values in the economy. It should be able to reduce transaction cost, and it should be able to store as a value reference, store of value. Okay, so basically all your purchases should be able to be measured in terms of money in your home currency or in some relevant currency other than probably Bitcoin. Well, let's see what happens there. So we have had these historical developments in the payment system. We had this commodity money period, and nowadays we are living this fiat money period where we have this paper money, or nowadays in electronic form, basically mostly for most of the people. But nevertheless, it's decreed by governments as legal tender. The next step, for example, I very much suspect that, for example, in the UK and Sweden, they will be introducing the central bank digital currency as the legal tender within a couple of years' time. The development or the technical process have been developed there quite a lot already. So it could be something that is being introduced, let's say, in 3 or 5 years' time in Sweden and also in the UK, because the central banks have been doing lots of work on that. So this is actually something that is not necessary for you to even pay too much attention, because all of you know these steps in the development process of payment systems. We have the checks and electronic payment system, e-money, and the next step is the central bank digital currencies, actually, that we are going to be introducing. A funny thing, I actually should give you a reference or link to the one of the speeches of one of the governors of the Federal Reserve Board that seems to be very against central bank digital currencies. So he's pretty determined that the US system will never, or the Federal Reserve will never introduce a digital currency. And that is actually something that he gives a lot of points, bullet points there for the reasons for not to introduce that. But there are some question marks there that I will put that to the Moodle site so we can take a look at those arguments. And if anyone of you is interested in doing research about central bank digital currency, there's already one credit thesis that has been done in our department. So it's an interesting theme. What would be the requirements for the introduction of the reliable central bank digital currency? What are the technical requirements and what are the regulatory requirements and what are the liquidity requirements and so on. So are we headed for a cashless society? What's your personal opinion? Don't pay too much attention to my notes there. What's your personal opinion? Are we heading towards that? Yeah. So basically this is a current textbook idea, but I think that this is a bit vague statement at the moment, because the central banks have been very active in starting to develop these digital currencies due to the emergence of these other more illegal forms of digital currencies that are being heavily used. Yeah.
Can we consider cryptocurrency as a first try implementing?
Yeah. They are kind of a cryptocurrencies that you have to use. But the most important thing is that when do the central banks make the decision to regard some cryptocurrency as a legal tender? What are the requirements for that? How stable should the valuation of that currency be? What are the main fundamental things actually that determine the valuation of that currency? That's the main thing. Because the valuation of that currency should be in the target function of that central bank. So it should have important role, for example, in the determination of the real economic activity or other things, stability of the financial markets. Bitcoin is actually increasing the instability of the financial markets because it's a highly speculative thing. Its value varies a lot within a week or within a month, let alone within 1 year. So it's something that cannot be perhaps regarded as a stable thing, a stable coin. But there are some things that are interesting actually in the fundamental things that affect the valuation of Bitcoins. For example, the volatility, we have done a paper with one of my colleagues from University of Vaasa that we find that actually one of the fundamental factors having an effect on the valuation of so-called stable coins is the volatility in the Bitcoin returns. So these currency, cryptocurrency markets, they are very much connected. And central banks just have to make a decision what is the relevant information there that has a role to play in the determination of the value. Okay. So electric money in some form or other will increase its importance in the near future. So here's a reference to the Bitcoin discussion, and this is actually a very nice short paper where you can take a look at the speculative aspects of the Bitcoin markets in terms of its future, because we already have derivatives markets for Bitcoin valuation. We have futures. So you can play against the future development of valuation of Bitcoin, against or in favor of that by taking part in the futures market for the Bitcoin assets. So that is actually one possibility that you can do. Take a look at that paper if you are interested about this. So here are the various definitions for the measurement of the money. So because we have run out of time already, take a look at these slides independently on the ways to measure the money and the listings about the values. I will put a note also or send a message through Moodle what are the slides that you have to take a look at independently, because these are just definitions. What are included as specific items into the definition of M1 and what are included into the definition of M2, M3, and so on. The main idea there is that the more the number of definition increases, the longer is the maturity of the items that are being included. So by far the shortest maturities are included to M1. Once the maturity starts to increase in terms of the individual items, you go to M2 and M3 and so on. These are just definitions. So take a look at these slides and development of these individual time series until this point of measuring interest rates. We will go to this slide tomorrow and start from this slide because it's perhaps the most important thing for you to understand about the main things here in the course. Okay, so we'll continue from this tomorrow. See you.